Public Safety Subcommittee to order. We continued over, and we're going to open the hearing on House Bill 5048 this morning. We apologize to the DA's budget, and we appreciate you being here, but we did carry over from the Public Defense Services Commission. I try and avoid acronyms when I'm around Representative Butler, so
for those of you who
don't know.
That's the PDSC.
That's the PDSC. I'm worried about you if you're starting to speak in representative. I asked Peter to give some to narrow down the scope and focus, so we're going to try and run through this but ask questions. If people can hold questions to the end or write them down so that we can at least get through the overview, we'll try and save enough time up for questions, but I want to make sure that we do get to the DAs who have traveled from out of town and others who have traveled from out of town to be here today. Go ahead.
Chair Patridge, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Ozan. I'm Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. And I thought today, I have in mind the time and I have in mind the questions the committees have, so I'll be brief in my opening remarks. I thought, by the way, the audience full of my colleagues in prosecution, the district attorneys, were simply here to testify on behalf of indigent defense again. We had so many good witnesses the last couple of days, but I know they have business to do here that's in addition to our work. I appreciated the committee's attention to our guests who came, as you know, from all parts of the state and all parts of the criminal justice system. I wanted to just emphasize a couple of points that over those 2 days. About 5 years ago, my own career took a turn when I left business law practice and came back to the criminal justice profession. The United States Attorney General asked me to help her with a pet project of managing a project in 5 cities to reduce gun violence among youths 15 to 21. And I briefed her about every other month in Washington, D.C., and she always started out by asking, "What's keeping you up at night, Peter?" That was how she always started out. So I'm going to tell you what's keeping me up at night now as the head of what I think to you all is a relatively important state agency. And they certainly, the things that keep me up at night are the ones that bother you as well, and we heard much of it, and I won't repeat them. The reduction in prosecutions of crime due to the fact that at least now, and perhaps we're hoping not, but into the next biennium there aren't a defense counsel. The threats to public safety, the delay to victims as well as criminally accused of prosecution of crimes, the general essential degradation of public safety and quality of life in Oregon. All those things are of concern to all of us. I just wanted to highlight a couple of other things. In the course of working on the reduction of gun violence, and my colleagues in the prosecution community could emphasize this in more ways in Oregon, we found one of the most important, I would say, in my opinion, the single most important public safety tool was probation violation. In fact, as I shopped this idea around, I call it the Oregon model, because in the last 2 years I've been consulting a lot of other federal prosecutors, and I said, if you can get in your state the system of administrative sanctions that we have in Oregon, it's a wonderful device. What we did is we identified high-risk offenders, many of whom had minor crimes on their record, and they were under probation. And we used that device of sanctioning them and bringing them in for a couple of days of jail to cut through a spiral of gang life, of drug dealing, or in many cases, drug use and abuse. So having that ability to focus on a population of high-risk offenders and yank them into jail or other sanctions on short notice with the threat of a hearing is a very strong public safety device, and we emphasize that in our program. And as our witnesses said today, we're losing that in Oregon by virtue of the fact that an offender who's threatened with these administrative sanctions will say, "Baloney, I'm not going to jail for a couple of days because I know there's not going to be an attorney or a hearing." So that device is lost to us, and I think that's a major threat to public safety and effective law enforcement. The second point I wanted to make goes to many of the questions Representative Butler had throughout the course of the hearing, which I'll generally say have to do with the shift in emphasis of resources in the system. If we're losing in the low-end offenses presently due to the lack of counsel, the ability to prosecute them, are we going to shift our resources, or should we shift them to other areas? I would suggest, and this is a prediction that my colleagues in the audience could affirm or not, but my prediction is that the system will work wisely by shifting its attention to those matters that count. In other words, without sanctions and consequences to those low-end crimes, wise police, this is not criticism, this is what I'd be doing, wise police departments and wise prosecutors will focus on the crimes that have consequences. They'll be more serious and they'll be more complex. And from the current, what keeps me up at night, just as we are cutting back on defense contracts because of the current cutbacks and to public defense contractors, I predict they may be facing a new volume of cases, more complex, as the system reacts to the current consequences. That's one of the second point that keeps me up at night. And finally, the one that we didn't talk much about over the last 2 days, and I know you're aware of this. You know, we don't just in our office of the Public Defense Services Commission handle criminal cases. Nearly a good portion, a little over half, is criminal cases, but a large portion are civil cases, and they are child abuse and neglect cases. And you all know this is, as of yesterday, Child Abuse Prevention Month.
I'd encourage the committee to look at the handout that was originally provided, if you still have that.
Yeah, it was
on the 31st, on pages 10 and 11. So that you get an idea of what the, I think this is what it, this is what it looks like. Is this the same one?
Yes. I was going to ask Ann to go through that, but I appreciate you bringing it to our attention. But that get. Well, 10 and 11 give you a breakdown of the kinds of cases we handle.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to make some copies or get some copies made?
Generally, people have them. Okay. Yeah. We've got them. Okay. Go ahead, Peter.
All right. Well, I was going to say, you know, what keeps me up at night is this notion of what will happen to the services we now deliver to children in neglect and abuse cases if, again, we're facing the kind of funding crisis we face now. So those are just a few of the things that I wanted to highlight. And I think now, in the interest of time, because Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I will have Ann Christian and Pete Gartland come up now. I'd like to introduce them, and then they will address many of the questions, Chair Patridge, that you highlighted yesterday. Pete and Ann.
Thank you, Peter.
If I might just take a second to introduce both of them. Of course, Ann Christian needs no introduction. 14 years with the Indigent Defense Services Division, testifying here probably in seven sessions. I wanted to make one observation. As you know, when we merge, Ann and Pete will be key members of the management team, and we will be integrated as a public defense services system. When I thought about taking this job, one of the places, of all places, I worked from time to time was at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. They have a public management program there, and they often have symposium on matters of public management, including public defense. And I know Ann's participated in symposiums and written white papers or been involved in white papers at the Kennedy School. I called some folks there to ask them, where does Oregon rank in terms of public defense services around the country? And my friend said, at the very top, among the top two or three best managed systems in the country. And I say that because if you look at the org chart and see the size of the budget, with very few people in her organization, she has managed over the years something in the neighborhood of $140 to $160 million budget with under a dozen people. So it's a very thinly managed but very effectively managed system. I also wanted to introduce Pete Gartland, and with your permission, since I know many of your questions are directed to Ann, I wanted Pete to talk about the appellate office briefly first to be sure that you have some knowledge of the problems in what's going to be called our legal services division. This is the 26 lawyers who used to be called the state public defender's office. They handle the appeals in the state, and that's the office where I'm currently housed and the agency over which I now have any authority. When I looked around, and Pete Gartland will be the leader of that office, and is already, but when the merger takes place, and when I talk to folks, both friends in the profession and particularly people on the appellate courts. I asked about Pete because I was already I knew it was the right decision. And the only thing they had to say, of course it's the right decision, but don't take him out of the appellate courts. He's one of our best advocates. And fortunately for us, he's also one among his many duties at the office is to train the young lawyers. Pete is the one person, I think we have the best training program I've ever seen of young lawyers, because he handles young lawyers, works with them in the cases as they're preparing them in the beginning, and then also goes to court with them for the first few months as they're arguing. And to begin with, I'd like to have Pete describe some of the functions of the office and some of the challenges we're facing in just a few minutes, and then we'll leave the rest of the time for Ann. Pete.
The committee's edification on the budget, there may be, as we look at this, there may be a hole in this appellate side of the budget. So we need to pay close attention to where we're at. That's something that Robin and I have looked at. And so if you want to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Gartland. I'm the Chief Deputy Defender with the Office of Public Defense Services, and as Peter explained, we used to be called the State Public Defender. Our caseload is pretty much strictly direct criminal appeals. What that means is we're really the second leg in the system. We follow a prosecution in the trial court, and what our function is essentially is to be structural engineers. We read a transcript, and then the attorneys identify potential issues, and what they're looking for is whether or not the judge made a legal error. And then we research that, discuss it, brief it, and orally argue. As of this morning, just to give you a general idea of the office, we have about 24 line attorneys who do the bulk of the legal representation in our office, and we have 2,674 open cases in the office as of this morning. Essentially, that reduces to, on an average, or at least each attorney has at least 90 cases to monitor. And please feel free to interrupt me at any time if you want, and perhaps you have different rules, but I'm accustomed to being interrupted, and I might even call you Your Honor.
I don't have lights or anything up here. So.
But the...
I mean, you could get your powdered wig.
The bulk of my presentation...
Don't show your age, Representative.
We won't for a long time since I've been in the courtroom once.
The bulk of my presentation is really at pages 29 through 32 of that handout. I'd be happy to take any questions, as I said.
Which one of the?
Sorry, this handout.
Okay. Got it.
And the last four pages are devoted to our office. If you would like, I could walk us through the appellate process, but I perhaps everyone's familiar with that and really doesn't need that walkthrough, but if anybody wants that, I'd be glad to do it.
I think we've kind of had a walkthrough because we've had the DOJ budget as to the appellate process, so.
Okay. Then I'll go to perhaps, and maybe I'm jumping ahead too far, but I know the committee is strapped for time, so I'm going to restrict my comments, at least initially the opening comments, to what would happen if our office were underfunded and understaffed. Because I think Ms. Lamont mentioned that yesterday, the consequences of understaffing our office. And what would, before we even start, I think the first thing to recognize is, again, we are the second leg in the process. So clients have a constitutional right to representation on appeal. And we handle cases where the DA has already decided that this case is worthy of its resources. I've heard Dale Penn say in the past, and he'll probably affirm this, is that the appellate process should be funded first, because the DAs have already invested they've chosen some certain cases to say, this is where we want to devote some resources. So for them, this is a conviction that they have in hand that they don't want to lose. So I think you would hear the DA say that, yes, the appellate process is critical and crucial and need be funded on an indigent defense basis. Obviously, if our office is understaffed or underfunded, there would be stress on the system. And the stress would probably take the form of dismissals by the Court of Appeals, because the Court of Appeals gives us deadlines within which to complete briefing the case. If we don't meet that deadline, the Court of Appeals will dismiss the case. What would happen then is that the case would go into post-conviction relief. In post-conviction relief, a court would appoint another attorney to represent that client. The attorney general would be involved to defend. And if the case has been dismissed, I can almost guarantee that the petitioner, the defendant, the client, would succeed, would prevail. And the remedy would be appointment of another defense counsel to represent that person on appeal. So essentially that it would be doubling the cost. There would be another cost involved, and that is the cost of that second direct appeal counsel, in addition to the post-conviction counsel and the attorney general's involvement. Another risk, and I think it's a real serious one, and I'm not trying to hold up any hobgoblins, but it's something to seriously consider, and that is if the cases take too long, at some point the federal courts will be interested, because there are cases from other states, I'm sure of Illinois, and I think it's Oklahoma, where if the cases took, I think it's 2 years between the time of notice of appeal and a decision, the federal courts have said that's taking too long. The remedy would be release of that defendant pending appointment of counsel to process the appeal. So that's another hidden cost that's out there if we run the risk as a state of not processing, not appointing counsel, adequate counsel on appeal. So there would be litigation costs for the state attorney general's office, and in addition to release of these defendants who would be, let's say, serving penitentiary time pending prosecution of the appeal. And again, unless there are any questions.
Peter, can you take us through, well, I said they understand the appeals process. They don't understand how your office necessarily would process, what the opportunities for your office to review cases are, Dauphin and the other pieces. So I don't want to circumvent that. Page 30 of the outline kind of gives us, lets the committee know how you handle cases internally, how they arrive to you.
Okay. And if I could start at page 31, actually. And that gives you an indication of how many cases come into the office every month. That's a chart and a graph. And it shows you, for instance, that February of 2003, we took in 100 cases. And our staff can handle 74 cases a month. So we took in 26 cases more than we can actually handle. So that gives you some idea. And you can tell from the graph, the numbers go up and down, but the average is that we take in 87.2 per month more than we can handle. Excuse me, we take in 87.2 a month and we can handle 74. So when a case comes in, and let's say the transcript is in, because what happens, our attorneys have to do some work. We have to contact trial counsel, find out what dates need to be designated. In other words, what were the dates in the trial court where proceedings were held, dates that we would need, transcripts of proceedings that we would need in order to review what happened below. And that attorney would then file a motion, notice of appeal, with the Court of Appeals. After typically, I think it's 45 days by statute, the court reporter has 45 days to file a transcript. The transcript comes in and it settles 12 days after that. that case typically would go on to our attorney's caseload. And our attorney's caseload is quite long. Just to give you an idea, our attorneys have approximately, on average, 35 cases to brief that have brief due dates. So that next case would be number 36. And to give you an idea how many cases is appropriate, the ABA sets a standard of 24 cases per attorney per year. So we are well above that. You know, we could stop taking cases today and our attorneys would have enough work by ABA standards for a year and a half. By our standards, it would be about a year because we happen to be fairly productive, if I don't mind saying that myself. So let's say the case came in. It would be case number 36. We would get to that several months down the road. An attorney would review that transcript, take notes, identify potential legal issues, research those issues, talk about those issues at team meetings. Our office is divided up into four teams. We have groups of attorneys, and they meet once per week, typically for an hour to an hour and a half, and they discuss several things. One of them is the cases they're working on. So they would research those issues. They would make a decision, typically after a team meeting, what kind of a case is this? Is this a case that's meritorious? That is, it presents a culpable claim of error, something that we could brief and argue in the Court of Appeals, or is this case, do we think that it's non-meritorious? And that's that first kind of fork in the road. It's about a third of the way down in the chart. Our office or our attorney would make a decision. If it lacks merit, it would go into a Balfour pile. That's that. That's the avenue on the right. The attorney would write a letter explaining to client all the potential issues in the appeal, but why those issues are not meritorious. And we would urge the client or advise the client to dismiss. If the client didn't want to dismiss, the client could write a Section B, it's called, but it's kind of a pro se brief, and we would attach that and submit it to the court. Going to the other half of the chart, a case has merit. The attorney would, like I said, research and write a brief, then argue it in the Court of Appeals, and then after the Court of Appeals ruled on it, and I'm leaving out the Attorney General's part in this, but the Attorney General, if we file a brief, the Attorney General will respond. So, and then at oral argument, we would argue, and the attorney, somebody from the Attorney General's office would argue, and then the Court of Appeals will issue a decision. Then after that, if we've lost, and that's, we lose more than 90% of the time, the attorney makes a decision with the client's input about whether or not to petition for review. And a petition for review is a request to the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, to review this case, to review the case. And if the case, if the court allows review, my goodness, that attorney just has a professional challenge of his or her career, because it's a heck of a nice challenge. It's an opportunity to be in the state Supreme Court and address an issue that the state Supreme Court thinks is vital and pivotal to the development of the criminal law of the state of Oregon. So that's kind of how it works in our office.
Chair.
Representative Bowe.
Two questions, Peter. Just one, how many attorneys, to accommodate this, how many attorneys do we have? What's the total size of the staff? I've been looking for that in the book, and I haven't been able to find that.
Sorry.
And then some sort of an idea as to the timeline so that we could maybe get some idea of the timeline and then how many of the cases are spun out at the end. After all of the appeals process and the final fork to the Supreme Court determination, what's the total number of cases that move one direction or another? I see the 6%, and I guess if I took the total cases in a year, that'd be 87 cases a month, assuming, well, actually, I guess 74 cases a month, that's all you've got capacity to handle.
Yeah, and if I could, Representative Butler, your first question was how many staff do we have, and that's at page 7. There are we have 24 what I would call line attorneys, attorneys who are devoted solely to processing the appeals.
Okay, I was adding. Okay, all right.
Sorry.
We have a staff of 24 attorneys.
Correct.
And so those 24 attorneys handling 74 cases, and what's the time load timeline for a case, taking it through your matrix on number 30, your work process chart? Mm-hmm. Total of 144 hours, but that's over how many months from the initial appeal?
And Representative Butler, that's only for cases where review is allowed. So there's another fork in the road. So that's down the line. If I could, from the top, direct appeal process, the first fork, does a case have merit or not? If it doesn't have merit, and 48 right now, 48% of our cases have been categorized as not having merit. So the other 52% are the cases that we will brief, going down the left side.
Right.
So you go down there, the subtotal for our office, the average of briefing a case, a merit appeal, and arguing it and writing a petition for review is 61 and a half hours.
So of the total cases that are actually appealed, the direct appeal process, approximately half after the first fork in the road, approximately half are determined to have merit, 52%.
Yes.
And then of those cases, 6% of those cases end up actually where the review is allowed. And so basically, if we divided it, basically 3% of all the cases that are filed with an initial appeal are actually reviewed briefs then.
I think the 6% is actually of all cases. I apologize if I misspoke before. So
6% of all cases submitted to the Supreme Court are actually allowed.
And that's
yes.
Only half of them.
I don't see the chief shaking it.
Well, that's not true for all 950 for review we handle a year.
I made, Chair, Representative Butler, the Supreme Court review is what we lawyers call discretionary review. I don't know if you know that the piece. So many cases will land at the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court will choose not to take review because they only look to cases, and of course the Chief can correct me here, but to cases of having particular significance across the state. So that's one of the reasons that not everybody gets a shot at the Supreme Court.
Right. I guess, Mr. Chair, what I'm looking at is, as I look at the first fork in the road, a third of the way down the page, as Peter has pointed out, the cases are basically split 50-50, those that lack entirely and those that go on, 52% that go on. At that point, then, at some point, the Supreme Court would examine those cases, those 52% of the cases. 94% of those lack merit and review is denied, but 6% of those have merit. That's about 3% of those that entered into the system at the top end because they've already been divided in half.
Well, I think it would be 62%, or I mean, it would be 6% of the 52%,
right.
Approximately.
Right.
Okay. If you had to do it, so
which would be about 3 cases out of 100, approximately.
It's a small. It's a very small number. Yeah.
Now, and the time that it took to get from for those cases, the timing, what's the average time? That's one of the performance standards we've used is timeliness of cases, and that you mentioned that that's fodder for U.S. Supreme Court issues if we're not timely. So what is the time average
now,
on top of bottom?
Yes, Representative Butler, now I understand. They're talking, the federal court is talking about a decision by the Court of Appeals. So within 2 years of filing a notice of appeal, the federal court is interested in seeing that the Court of Appeals has issued a decision, not the Supreme Court.
Oh, okay.
If that clears that, yeah.
Okay.
Now I understand. I apologize.
Okay. No, that's fine. So 2 years, 2 years before it ever even gets to the docket.
Before the Court of Appeals. Well, before the Court of Appeals, it's a double layer, Court of Appeals, and then the Supreme Court.
Right.
So the first layer of review is the Court of Appeals, and the federal court is saying that cases should be decided by the Court of Appeals within 2 years after the notice of appeal is filed.
Okay.
What's your average length of time now?
Right now, the last I checked, it's around 296 days for us to file the appeal in a average case. And so that essentially leaves the state and the Court of Appeals with about a little over about 450 days.
But
so
when's
doing
the
my math right.
How long does it take for a decision to come back from original trial court determination and judgment?
From
the trial court judgment to review, what's the average length of time to a final?
By the Court of Appeals?
Decision by the Court of Appeals. What's it?
We're well under the 2 years right now. Some cases, however, that are taken under advisement will take longer in the Court of Appeals. But as of yet, the federal public defender, nobody has stepped in to say, hey, state court system, you're not processing these appeals quickly enough, because the bulk of them are being processed within that two-year limitation.
But I think the thrust of Representative Butler's question and the thrust of the committee is, as we're allocating resources in this budget environment, both to the court and your office and Department of Justice, what's the length of time? We have to have a margin of error, and obviously we don't want to skate it right up on the edge of running afoul of the feds, but what's the average length of time?
Well, I can tell you the average length of time for our office, and that is to file the brief. We're using up on average roughly 300 days.
Well, maybe Robin can get that. Robin, can you get that from the court and DOJ? We're looking at time of judgment at the trial.
Actually, notice
court
of
level.
Appeal.
Okay.
What's that?
Sorry. Actually, notice of appeal.
Is the 2 year is the
starting
year.
Right.
Okay.
Is the starting point.
Notice of appeal is the initiated.
Yes.
Is that
2 year tolling?
Yes.
And that's the initial to initiate the appeal is the notice of appeal that you're receiving.
Right.
Okay.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I think we're kind of missing a point. Obviously, we don't want to bump up against a two-year limit that creates problems. But you've got a certain amount of workload. And if you just extend that workload, you've still got the same amount of work that you've got to do. It's just a question of when you're able to get to it. The sooner that we can deal with these, it seemed to me it'd be better for everybody, because in the cases where they might have to go back for retrial, I think it'd be a lot easier finding witnesses and things if that's done sooner rather than later. And then even in terms of somebody that's incarcerated, that I'm wondering if it would affect how they deal with incarceration if they know that their appeal issues have been removed. Anyway.
Peter, go ahead.
Representative Hansen, if I could, when I say that someone would be released, let's say the federal courts got involved and said, state appellate system, you're not processing these appeals quickly enough, what a defendant would get would be release, but not the conviction wouldn't go away. That person would be released until the state provided that person with counsel to prosecute the appeal. So once the appeal was filed, I would imagine, and argued, then that person would be taken back into custody. And if I could, perhaps if you could turn to the last page of this handout to show you we've made some significant progress with backlog. Thanks to Ann Christian's office, we've been able to revert through a contract roughly 16 cases per month beginning January of 2002. And you can see, based on this chart only goes back to June of 2000, our backlog is actually in a better position right now than we have been for the last 3 years. And it's going in the right direction. Excuse me?
Could you explain what NFE means?
Oh, I'm sorry. NFE is just an acronym. I thought this committee really liked acronyms, but it's an
no,
acronym.
No, no, no. If Representative Butler and his committee has the General Government Committee has a piggy bank up there, and every time you use an acronym, you have to put in 2 bits.
Okay. It's an acronym imposed by the Court of Appeals.
Not us. It's a court-ordered acronym.
Charge them.
It stands for no further extensions. So it's an absolute drop-dead line. The Court of Appeals is saying you must have this case brief submitted by this date, and that date right currently is 350 days after record settlement.
350 days.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could go back on just one issue, if I may. I had taken some notes, and I had a note here showing Keith Garland down as the Chief Deputy Public Defender. Is that right?
Yes.
But I have 2 FTE there. Do you work twice as hard as anybody else?
I sure do. Thank you.
I need to pay your income tax.
No, actually, we have someone else who's been... His name is Jess Barton, and Peter has recruited him to return to the office, and right now he's on a half-time basis, but he will be back on a full-time basis beginning in the next biennium as of July of this year. And he's an expert in caseload management, and he's also an excellent attorney. We're really happy to have him back.
And then under that, I show the 24 attorneys that were the senior deputy and the public defender deputies, 1 and 2. Or 2 and 1, as the case may be, and the 9.5 FTE legal secretaries and 2 office specialists, or well, 1 office specialist and 1 office assistant 2, for a total of actually I show with the executive director and the assistant total of 39.5 in that department.
Okay. Representative Butler, Chair Patridge, if I may add that one way to look at this is after the merger, essentially Pete will be the chief defender and really occupy a box that would really where the executive director is. You know, I'll be after the merger, and then there will be on page 9 an office of director, and he will be the lead defender. We look at page 9 versus page 7.
Mr. Chair, may I just bounce around right there if I could while we're talking about that merger? I have 39.5 on page 7, and I have 10.2 on page 8, but I have a total of 55.8 on page 9. Is there no efficiency in merging these?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what these charts do not show are some overhead staff within, I don't know if overhead's the right word, some staff that are currently within the judicial department that are doing things like paying bills that will be transferring that don't show up on this chart.
I see.
There are actually 20.1 FTE that are transferring in.
So that do not show on either one of the preliminary
half of
charts.
Half of which don't show on this chart.
Okay.
So can we get a revised chart so we can compare what Dan's for Shop's currently doing and what we're going to
do? Well, these are coming. We'd be happy to. Ann, do you want to address that? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I understand that this was an issue on Monday, and what is not reflected on these charts is the fact that Ann Christian, and I'm Director of Indigent Defense Services Division. The current Indigent Defense Program has much involvement by court staff, including actually judges as well. And so judges currently, up until the transfer occurs, are reviewing billings that come in for indigent defense. They also have staff who are reviewing billings and requests for non-attorney expenses. As part of our transition, we looked at the number of positions in the court that we felt were providing indigent defense support, because it's not simply my office with 10.2 individuals. Our analysis indicated there were 13.32 local court staff who were providing indigent defense administrative services, in discussions with the Judicial Department as far as how many staff will actually transfer.
Plus 13.32 then.
13.32 FTE are the number of local court staff that
are demonstrated on the first or second page.
Exactly.
Okay.
And with the Judicial Department, the short answer is recognizing that we need to be more efficient than the current system is, where local courts are involved in all the billings. My office, Peter's office, will be centrally handling all of those. We compromised with the Judicial Department and took half, six positions. So those are the six position differences between the three org charts.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can go through that in detail at some later point in time with Robin, so we have a better understanding, Anna, of what that is. All right. Anything further on the appellate piece? Charlotte, thank you. I certainly appreciate it. Anne, do you want to go ahead and take us through the...
I will, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Anne Christian, Indigent Defense Services Division, soon to be part of the new Public Defense Services Commission and the Office of Public Defense Services. We really look forward to that. And what I thought I'd do with the limited amount of time, there were a number of questions that came up over days one and two. I prepared, to assist me to keep on track, answers to those questions that were raised. I do want to quickly go through some of the materials. I think by doing that, we'll answer some of the questions along the way. But I first want to say thank you to Peter Ozan for the kind remarks. And when he mentioned the Kennedy School, I immediately thought, oh, my goodness, in the response to Representative Butler's questions with regard to travel and that type of thing, I did not include that. And I just want to assure you that the two out of the five meetings I was able to attend for that, what was really a good educational experience for me, were paid personally by me. So I'm going to start you on the original handout, page 14.
All right. And everyone's abandoning us, but that's all right.
That's okay. We'll go fast.
Quality, not quantity. Mr. Chair, I have a grandson.
I saw your grandchildren. Are you going to introduce them to the committee?
I certainly will.
All right.
Okay. I have what is a one-page overview of what is the Indigent Defense Program currently. And it really has two components. One is administration. That's primarily my office, the Indigent Defense Services Division, comprised of a total of 10.2 FTE. Our funding for this biennium is a little less than $1 million. When you compare that to the responsibility we currently have, that's less than 1% of the total program cost. Our management to staff ratio is 1 to 11. And the second component of Indigent Defense Program is, in fact, all of the service delivery that's provided in every single county in this state. And it's a privatized service delivery. We have no state employees at the trial level. We do some appeals, but for simplifying things, I'll refer to what we provide as trial services. And it's all privatized. We have 91 contracts. 10 of those are with public defender nonprofit entities. And we have approximately 500 attorneys who take cases on an individual basis. And we do have some contracts with non-attorneys. The Portland Police Bureau, we have a contract with for 911. Records Forensics Laboratory. We found that is the most efficient way to handle defense attorneys' needs for forensic services. Page 15 is just a chart that shows you what types of cases is it that the state of Oregon is mandated to provide counsel, and why is it that the state of Oregon is mandated to provide counsel in cases that range from aggravated murder to post-conviction relief to abuse and neglect. Representing children. What a doll. Representing children.
Are we going to have an introduction?
This is an abused and neglected child.
We can tell.
This is my granddaughter, Kirsten Huddleston.
Welcome, Kirsten. Can
you say thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Go ahead.
The range of cases that the state of Oregon is required to provide state paid counsel for is on page 15, and this chart shows the basis of the mandate, whether it's the Oregon Constitution, whether it's the federal constitution, or whether it's by state statute. One of the cases that we've heard quite a bit about during the hearings are post-conviction relief cases that primarily are in Salem and in eastern Oregon, because that's where our Department of Corrections institutions are. And those cases, the post-conviction relief, are the one of all these case types that clearly are not constitutionally mandated. It's simply by a state statute. Many of the issues that have been brought up during the first 2 days deal with eligibility, financial eligibility of an individual to receive court-appointed counsel. And on page 16, I've tried to set forth just a real basic, clear explanation of how the courts determine whether or not, if I were in court, how would they determine whether or not I would qualify for court-appointed counsel. And the starting point is with a constitutional and statutory standard that's set out. But it's one thing to have a statute that says appoint counsel in those instances where the individual does not have adequate resources to hire counsel without causing substantial hardship in providing necessity, basic economic necessities. You have to have guidelines to actually implement that. And so it's a two-pronged test that I've set forth on that handout, and we are fortunate to have still some court staff who assist the courts in making...
And I think you lost us.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Handout.
Where are you?
Page 16.
Okay.
Oh, there's your two-pronged test. Okay.
Financial eligibility. Sorry, I'm trying to
We both
fast.
Got distracted. We apologize.
That's your prerogative, to be distracted. I will try not to lose you again if I can.
No. You're fine. And just on the first and second prong,
sure.
Can you provide us what you asked the applicants to fill out? Just a copy of the form. Is that in the...
It's in the handouts
okay.
today.
I just wanted to make sure that we got that to committee members so they could see it. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, actually, in the handout from today, I have a real-life example at page 7.
Okay. Well, hopefully we may go through that if more of the committee shows up.
Okay. And that is from your home district of Jackson
if
County.
If not, it will be homework with a mandatory test the following day.
And now I've lost my place, so we're not.
I don't know how Justice Carson does it.
16.
Yeah,
we're just finishing up.
So, Mr. Chair, shall I move forward?
Yeah, please continue.
On page 17 is a breakout to give you an idea of the types of cases and the percentage of the indigent defense caseload that is criminal and juvenile and other types of cases like post-conviction relief. So at page 17, what we've shown you is the breakout of each of the primary case types, criminal, juvenile, contempt, and probation violation. An issue that's always of importance, at least within my shop, the courts, and to you as well, begins on page 18.
I just want to stop here for a second, make sure any of the committee has questions or needs any. The juvenile caseload is not something that we've gone through in regards to what the difference, what a dependency is and some of those types of things. Is that helpful to the committee to understand those, or should we keep moving? You want to keep moving? I'm seeing keep moving.
I can say quickly, dependency and review cases have been our fastest growing cases over the past 10 years, require a specialization by attorneys. Page 18 begins just six quick charts with regard to indigent defense expenditures, and these show expenditures from 1994 through our projected 2003 expenses, which we have adjusted to not take into account the budget reduction scenario that we're currently in, so that it is apples and oranges comparison. Page 19 shows you the most significant part, the largest part of our expenditures, and those are for the 91 contracts statewide that have the private businesses providing legal representation in the local courts. It's almost $59 million of $75 million are for those contracts.
December. Is that $59 million annual?
Annual.
Okay, and that's December 31st or June 30 annual?
June 30 annual. These are all of the numbers that I have to present are all noted as fiscal year ending, meaning June 30 of the year noted. So the largest part of our expenditures clearly are the contracts. And on page 20, that chart going from 1994 to projected 2003 shows you what we call non-attorney expenses. So all the expenses for interpreters, investigators. This chart in particular does not include transcripts. Transcripts relate back to what Mr. Gartland was talking to you about earlier. The Indigent Defense Program is responsible for paying the cost of the transcripts that support those appeals that Mr. Gartland talked about, and those transcripts, you can see from the next chart, are about $1 million a year out of a total amount of about $6.8 million. So it's a substantial part of our expenses, and that's one area in particular, and it's, I guess I can say now as we're leaving the Judicial Department soon, that's been a particular bugaboo, if you will, with respect to expenditures that I've had. When we have had such limited money, to see that amount of money being spent on paper in these electronic times has been very troubling, and we are actively pursuing a contract with one entity to provide those services. I think it'll be a substantial savings. On page 22, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, yesterday Representative Hansen asked about the cost of death penalty representation for indigent defense, and that's shown on page 22. And it has ranged over the years from about $3.3 million in 1994. These, again, are annual numbers. We're projecting this year about this year ending June 30 of 2003, we're projecting about $4.7 million. Part of the reason for the increase is the fact that as a case, an aggravated murder case, moves through the system, what I mean is there's the original trial level case. There then is the direct appeal. That direct appeal is to the Supreme Court as opposed to the Court of Appeals. Most of those appeals are handled by the Office of Public Defense Services. We've been responsible for any appellate costs if the Office of Public Defense Services has a conflict of interest. If there were multiple co-defendants, they can only handle one. So first phase is the original trial. Second phase is the direct appeal to the Supreme Court. Third phase is post-conviction relief. In 1994, I believe we had one death sentence case that was in post-conviction relief. Over the years, what we're seeing is the post-conviction relief additional costs adding into these death penalty expenses.
So, Anne, at some point in time later, can you give us a breakout for total costs, whether it be appeals, PCR, or original
for
defense
death
costs, mm-hmm. so that we can break those out for the death penalty piece?
Absolutely. And on page 23, Mr. Chair, we have the non-attorney expenses broken out by types of expenses. Trial-level death penalty, 58 on the left-hand side of that. Almost 60% of those non-lawyer expenses are for investigation and mitigation. 4% for forensic work, so like what the state crime lab does for the state side. And on the non-death penalty side, again, a substantial portion, about a third, is for investigation services. one of the things that I think is important as a manager to look at is the trending of workload to expenditures, and that is on page 24 really shows it. And as Ms. Lamont provided in one of her charts during her overview, the increase in expenditure really has tracked with the increase in caseload. In the original agency materials that we provided to you is more information about the correlation of caseload to expenditures, but what it boils down to, and I'm looking for my notes here, is that the average cost since 1993 for all cases, even if we put the death penalty cases in the mix, was $408. Over these 9 years, we're now at an average per case. This includes the non-attorney costs as well. So it's total costs. Gone from $408 per case to $443. It's about $4 per year, or less than 1%. Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on to our cost recovery programs, and that's on page 25 and 26. We're almost at the end.
You want to jump to your case example? You want to use your case example?
We could
as
do
part
that.
Of the recruitment piece to explain how it works and what happens when you process somebody?
Mr. Chair, that's a good idea. So you could shift to the handout we provided for today. And this really, we're going to take a minute or two to talk about the entire process of an individual coming into court, whether it's on a criminal case. That's what we chose to depict here. But it would be the same for a parent, for example, who has been brought into juvenile court with an allegation that the parent has abused and neglected their child to the point where the Department of Human Services has come in and taken the child away. It's the same process. So on page one of the handout for today, and I've seen so many flowcharts of the criminal justice system where, you know, you just look at it and you think there's no way I'm ever going to understand this. So we have limited this flowchart only to the eligibility determination and two revenue programs we have, the application contribution program and recovery at the end of the case. So an individual starts out in the court process, and that person is seen in most counties by a court staff person who's called an indigency verifier.
This is Chris, our defendant from Doug Harkle Road's production.
That's right. And Chris would first see whether or not Chris is in jail or whether Chris has been cited to appear in court. In the typical court, Chris would visit with a court staff employee and fill out a form that is a two-page financial form that requires specific financial information. And I've included a real-life example on page 7 of what the individual is required to fill out. And this is an example recently from Jackson County. It's an individual who's been charged with driving under the influence and some other attempt to elude a police officer, DUI and reckless driving. And you can see that the individual is required to give, it's blacked out, but Social Security number. Representative Butler yesterday asked the question whether or not we encounter problems or difficulties in obtaining information from other state agencies or federal agencies, which are a gold mine for information. And the answer is no, thankfully, because two things. We do have an Oregon statute that we requested back in 1989. It's ORS 151493 that provides any state agency that receives a request for information under this verification program that we call it shall release the information. Now, the verifiers have to get, and they do get, signed releases of information. The individual who is there applying for counsel is given a sheet of paper, and I brought the verification manual. This is what the court staff people use as their Bible, but the person has to sign these releases of information. We also have a nice notice that's 2 pages long that clearly tells these individuals that their Social Security number is their own. They do not have to provide it. And we simply tell them that it's their choice whether or not to provide that Social Security number. They don't have to. If they don't provide it, there will be a delay. And this is factual. There will be a delay in verifying whether or not they can have counsel appointed. So I would guess, I'm not out there anymore with the verifiers, but from the early 90s when I was, I would guess that 99% of the people put their Social Security number on this affidavit of indigence. And that allows credit bureau checks, that allows employment division, anything that a verifier has time to do. So if we can get back to our flow chart, the person in the court is getting this information with regard to the financial situation, and the verifier then goes through a worksheet. And if you look at page 9 in the handout, and imagine this verifier having, you know, in Multnomah County, you could have a verifier with 20 people stacked up waiting to be interviewed. And the verifier then goes through this worksheet and calculates different calculations to determine two things. One, whether to recommend to the court, to the judge, recommend that counsel be appointed. And now in 16 counties, not all 36, but the second thing the verifier recommends is, if the court's going to decide to appoint counsel, will the court order that person to pay two things? One's called an application fee. It's $20. It's the cost of going through the process of having this court staff person determine whether or not the person is eligible for court-appointed counsel. The second thing is a contribution amount, and we'll go through that in a little bit more detail in a second. Even for those individuals where the court decides not to appoint counsel, in other words, to send them on their way looking to hire an attorney, the courts can order that application fee because the individual has gone through that administrative service, and it costs money. And by state statute, we are allowed to recover that cost. So you have the court staff person. They're invaluable. They are absolutely invaluable. I'm going to take just a moment to say Oregon in the early 90s was nationally recognized for having this verification program. I mean, we get calls from Texas and every place. It's still a model program, I would say, but it's been a bit decimated over the past 5 years in particular because of court reductions. But I'll stop my whining there. It's a critical, critical program. So the court staff then make recommendations to the judge. If I'm the defendant, I go into the courtroom, and the verifier will have given the court the worksheet that they've figured all these calculations, and also the document that's at page 10. It's just one pager to the court as far as what the verifier is recommending. It's a judicial decision. The judge makes the decision whether or not counsel will be appointed. So you can have instances where a verifier, based solely on guidelines, assumptions, recommends to a judge that counsel not be appointed. But the court has the final decision, the court meaning the judge. And so the judge makes the decision, appoint counsel, not appoint. And the additional decisions, pay an application fee, pay a contribution amount. All of this happens in most courts in a period of, say, an hour. And so you can imagine that verifiers, the court staff, are not in a position on day one this morning to do anything more than make sure the affidavit is complete. That's one of the really good reasons for having verifiers. Yesterday, Judge Franz was asked, what was the process prior to the verification program, which started in 1989? And I can tell you from personal experience that the process in the early 80s was sometimes to have court-appointed counsel sitting out in the hallway assist individuals filling out the affidavit, which never feels comfortable, I think, for defense counsel. And in some courts, judges simply doing, as Judge Franz indicated yesterday, asking a defendant, you know, raise your right hand and swear you don't have any money to hire counsel. So the verification program brings great credibility to a system. And there are a number of people who, early on with the program, we learned once they knew someone was actually reviewing and looking at their financial information, and then also following up, they would decide maybe they'd go out and see whether they could hire an attorney rather than simply asking for it. So the verifiers, the court staff people, to the extent they have time, after the person, say, has been appointed counsel, will do the verification check. And I've included at the end of the handout just the table of contents from what's expected of these verifiers and all of the information and contact information that my office provides to them, because we remain responsible for the policy and the procedures for the statewide program. In my mind, unfortunately, we're no longer, my office is no longer responsible for the actual court staff people, but They do have, where they have resources available, the direction to check verification and make sure the information is correct. The final piece is recoupment. If an individual at the end of the case, and it's any individual, whether it's a criminal case, it used to be only criminal defendants who were convicted could be ordered by the court to repay the costs. In 1997, my office requested the expansion of that to any type of indigent defense case there is. So juvenile dependency, post-conviction relief, those are all open, and even cases, criminal cases where there's a dismissal or an acquittal. So we've expanded that program. And the recoupment program brings in about $7 million a biennium. Our application contribution program, as I indicated, we've been able to implement it in 16 out of 36 counties. And to date, during this biennium, it's brought in a little over $1 million, which we're pretty proud of, at $20 for an application fee. And in the materials are what the contribution amounts are for an individual who, say, has some money. And the real-life example in your handouts is an individual where he clearly did not have enough money to go out and retain an attorney on an attempt to elude in a DUI, but he clearly had, I think it was $350 that the court got immediately at the beginning of the case.
Okay. Ann, you want to talk real quick about, on page 2, I know that there's the income guidelines. We skipped mm-hmm. over those real quick, just mm-hmm. so the committee's aware of what the income guidelines are.
We all qualify, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, after a comment yesterday with regard to your salaries, I have in my head the family of four, head of household, and I hate...
There we were.
Yes.
Yep, so, you know, we need not worry about the law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for my interruption.
Mr. Chair, the income guidelines are the first prong of that two-prong test. And they are based, and they are updated every single year. They are based on federal food stamp guidelines. We figure if the federal government has made a determination of what eligibility for food stamps should be, that this should also be our first guideline. And it makes administration of the programs easier to administer. For a family of four, this guideline would be $23,532 annual gross income. Federal food stamps are based on an assumption that, and it must have been from the 60s, but that there is a federal poverty line, and that an individual who has income at 130% of whatever that federal poverty line is needs assistance in buying food. And so we've adopted the same, which is federal food stamps, which is 130% of the federal poverty rate. And so in looking, especially during, I guess it was fifth special session, third, actually, at all the alternatives we had to try to avoid the current crisis we're in, we looked at reducing the guidelines even more down to just the federal poverty rate. And what that would do for that family of four income at $23,532 is bring it down, and I didn't write down the exact amount. It's in all the materials you've been given, but it's about $18,000 a year gross income. And so then the question becomes, how many cases currently are appointed counsel where a family of four has an income of $23,000, we'll say, and how many cases wouldn't be appointed if the guideline were at $18,000. We have no data available to be able to determine that. We're asking a court to go back and look at records such that I provided you today to get a sample to see how much of a difference it will make. So we will provide that information to legislative, fiscal, and to you. People who are in the system, when I pose this question, they indicate they think it will not make a significant difference, that the individuals who are between 18 and 23,000, I mean, either people really, really don't have money or they have much more money than 23,000, but we'll report back on that.
Just so the committee knows, we appreciate Ann taking a look at that.
Mm-hmm.
It is a hard thing to ferret out. I think that there was also, we only have a couple minutes left. I need to get the DAs mm-hmm. on. I know that there was a question in regard to use by county, and if we can get a breakout by county of what the costs are and services we're sending to their various contractors. I think that would be helpful. I think Representative Hansen and I had a discussion about trying to look at to ferret out. There were some questions raised about charging decisions and other things the other day. So I think that if you have that or any other indicators that we could see by county, by caseload and population, who's using what. We understand also there's a lot of other variables surrounding what may or may not be driving those, but at least that's some kind of indicator. Other quick questions for the committee, and most of them I'd like to have them answered written, unless we need something real quick.
This probably won't take that. And if the person walks up in front of the judge and said, I do not have the income, I need the indigent defense, and it turns out that's not true, are there any consequences to that pledge? Okay.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, absolutely. We can go after, the district attorney's office can go after that person for false swearing. It's not perjury, but it's false swearing. We also have a civil remedy by state statute, and their counsel is withdrawn immediately.
And they're made aware of that before they make that.
Absolutely. At the top of that affidavit of indigence, and there's also an advice of rights that warns them of this, but on page 7, and it's small print, but it's there, because we've had to try to fit it on two pages, I would suggest, but it says, at the end of that top paragraph up here, I understand that if I do not tell the truth, I can be required to repay the costs to the state for providing court-appointed counsel, and or I can be charged with crime, and if convicted, I can be incarcerated.
Senator Devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for having to go in and out of the committee almost every day to other committees. And this question may have been asked already. In terms of this fee schedule that is given as part of this, is this an absolute fee schedule, or can the court actually, because of extenuating circumstances, because some of these fees, particularly for some of the felonies, just slightly less than aggravated murder. In my opinion, they wouldn't go too far in terms of, even if you were looking at what I've been told is the average rate that an attorney is being paid for these cases in terms of an hourly rate. But are they absolute, or can they be modified if there's extenuating circumstances?
Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, the short answer is they can be modified. I want to make sure you understand what these charts are. And the one I'm looking at is on page 3, and it's Jackson County.
Mm-hmm. Use mouth.
Are we looking at?
Lose mouth here, Ken.
Well, they have a lot of money.
What these are they're called privately hired attorney fee schedules. So again, we have the two-prong test. If I'm a defendant, do I qualify for food stamps? If I do, the presumption is I'm going to get court-appointed counsel. If I don't qualify for food stamps, that's not the end. The court looks at whether or not I could.
This is on page 16 of the other handout. If people, I know people were out when we had the two-prong test. You can look at that. Go ahead.
Whether, thank you, Mr. Chair, whether a person could go out and hire an attorney. So these charts are what the court uses to decide if I have $2,000 in the bank today, and I'm employed, you know, so I'm not down and out, would I have the ability to go out and hire an attorney to represent me? Let's just say we've been talking probation violations a lot. Felony probation violation. We did a survey of private attorneys, not indigent defense attorneys, in every single county for every type of case listed here, and we compiled their responses. So we asked them, for a felony probation violation case, retained, private hire, what would you charge? And of course, we got a range of responses from low to high. And what we determined is we are not expecting people to be able to go out and hire, I could name names that would mean something to me, you know, the best attorney in the state of Oregon. So we said, if you have, you know, 300 responses as far as what an attorney charges for a felony probation violation, we decided to be consistent and say we'll take the 25th percentile. So if the attorneys reported $100 for a felony probation violation or $5,000, we went with $500. So these are just what the court uses to make a determination. Your question is, can courts deviate? We try to suggest to courts not to deviate without our input, but as I indicated before, the judges make the final decisions, so they can deviate from these. These are intended to be guidelines for the verification staff and to help the courts, the judges.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Chair, and I don't want to load the process up, but I probably need someone to explain to me the whole process of post-conviction relief. I'm looking at post-conviction relief, and in terms of cost of out-of-pocket expenses and the total time and energy taken for post-conviction relief, it's second only to murder in the state as to an expensive process. And I just need to have some attorney sit down with me and explain what that's all about. And then I've got some other questions and still some questions about making certain that we're using technology. And then whether or not any of those, and I appreciate Ann taking us through the method by which they arrived at the 25th percent, the bottom quartile of those that were responding to the overall cost. I just wondered if in the, any of the cuts that we'd gone to any of our providers and asked them if they would be willing to take these cases on for something less, in order to spread the burden. I probably just need to spend just a few minutes. Maybe at the end of our presentations at a later date that can be done.
Absolutely. And Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I'd be happy to spend whatever time you have available. I know how precious that is, or to provide you any information you want. Post-conviction relief, we had Mr. Rader here, but we do have local individuals who do post-conviction relief who can, they're the most, I can tell you, Representative Butler, post-conviction relief cases are the most difficult cases for my office to find counsel to represent people on. Most difficult.
Well, we will have time to look at the post-conviction relief because I think the House Judiciary Committee is probably going to kick out a bill down here at some point in time that will repeal Oregon's post-conviction relief statutes, and that debate will take place in and around the building, but we'll have an opportunity, I think, to at least hear that bill from the cost-driving point of view. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily leaving this committee, but we will have that opportunity to have that discussion.
And Mr. Chair, relative to Gideon v. Wainwright, I thought I understood the Chief Justice to say that the result of that was that no one that was going to spend time incarcerated was going to do so without appropriate counsel. But then I see that we have on the schedule juvenile termination and juvenile parental rights on behalf of the child and on behalf of the parent.
I think if you look at page 15 of your original handout, it says what's required by the Oregon Constitution, the state constitution, the federal constitution, and gives those items. We are out of time for you all. We may bring you back again, but I certainly appreciate you being here. I appreciate people coming from out of town. Please, and Mr. Ellis, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
As well, we certainly appreciate it, and we appreciate your service to the state. To the chief, thank you. And we probably really don't even have time for wrap up.
You look like
we will pull you.
I'm saying
we will pull
you
from across the street. We'll let you say thanks.
We're
but
here.
Yeah,
we will be happy to meet with any of your members at any time to answer any other questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. If we can go ahead. What can we do here tomorrow? Doug's going to give us a real brief overview of the DAs and their deputies. Gary, who was here yesterday, we're going to make sure that Gary gets on so we can get him back on the road. Again, back to Crook County. We certainly appreciate it. And Doug Harkelrobe, we're going to try and get you on as well today so that we can get those things done. So if the two of you want to come forward, I'm going to have Doug go ahead and start on his piece.
Chair Patrick, I'm actually scheduled last in our order, and I've got to come back tomorrow anyway.
Okay.
So if that's okay, the committee will just go in our order.
All right, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I've handed out the typical memo. Should be in front of you. There are no budget notes, no e-board actions, or no audits with this agency. This is a different agency than most that will come forward. If you were to look at span of control, either have a zero or infinity, because district attorneys are the district attorneys themselves are locally elected, but they are state employees. All their deputies and other office people in those offices are local employees. So it's a matter of 36 managers to no staff, or zero staff to 36. So you have an interesting call. Did you get one of these?
Actually, technically, their deputies are state employees.
Are they?
For the purposes of the executive branch, according to the Attorney General.
otherwise, I still would be a deputy district attorney.
Well, then I apologize.
Can you get another one?
Yeah.
Okay. What I do want to do is go through a couple of major issues and then have Gary talk. Keep in mind that if you take a look in the third page of the handout, it's sort of some history, a chart that looks like this. 90, and you can see that it really has been pretty flat funding. But that doesn't tell the whole story because of a couple things that have been happening. If you take a look at the 0103 budget, the current 0103, you can see some decreases there, and then it does increase the 0305, but really what's happening there are three things. Based on the usual increases in employee compensation issues, PERS, health insurance, and the such, the compensation of those 36 district attorneys increases, and that's an increase in the bottom component of each bar. And then the other things happening that's increasing, we're going to talk about this tomorrow with someone from DAS. He'll be up tomorrow. David Hartwig, who's the head of risk management, there has been a significant increase in the admin, mainly the tort liability, and I'm sure you've heard this from the DAs themselves as they visited with you. And those two things have constrained the other two components of spending. The witness fees, of which there are nothing in the budget in 03054, and DA compensation, which has been reduced significantly to about $640,000 or $670,000, significantly decreased from previous biennia. So that will be sort of what's happening in this budget, and it is really unfortunate because you're really constraining those, you're really taking the fixed costs, the employee compensation and the admin tort liability, and constraining the other costs that then are picked up by local government because witness fees are statutorily required. And the DAs, DA deputies, I suppose they're not statutory required, but in most of these counties, the DA could not do everything himself.
The tort liability is from DAS risk management.
Right. I'm not on this.
Are we doing the grant of the DA and salary increases?
They are part of the automatic increases, just like any other state employee.
It's a significant job.
Right, and that is because the usual reasons like PERS increases, health insurance increases, the usual whatever other state employees.
Say no more.
Okay. Number two, I'm on back to the second page of the handout. Overall, the proportion of total DA spending has fallen from about 19% in 1975, this is a state component of it, to about 9% in the year 2000. Significant decreases there. Locals provide a significant amount of funding for this program. Mainly in the compensation for the DA, the deputy DAs. District attorney salaries generally increase, like I said, like rest of state employees, but in many cases, in fact, in the majority of the counties do augment the state salary with other compensation. In 2001, that compensation ranged from anywhere from $5,000 to $22,000 that the counties add to the DA salary itself. Funding for administration, I've talked about that. Issue number four, that's a tort liability. Number five is around the DA supplement, has fallen since 9901, 64%. Witness fees, number six, has been completely eliminated in the 0305 budget. And counties, as I say, in number seven, have had to make up the difference between actual costs and state support, given that witness fees are mandatory in statute. As no surprise, the ability of counties to backfill the lost state funding, they're under many of the same pressures that the state government is, so they are under difficulty. In fact, counties have laid off deputy DAs or are contemplating it. Most likely, or most notably, I think Multnomah County has laid off a number of DAs here in the past couple months, and I'm sure others are considering it.
So statutorily, the counties had the obligation to start off with, and it came into the state budget, now it goes back to the county's budget for witness fees?
For witness fees, there's a statutory, someone has to pay for it. The state has contributed over time, but that now has decreased to zero.
So when it says someone has to pay for it?
The counties do.
The counties.
And keep in mind, and this is a point that staff will continue to drive home, number nine, DAs are part of a larger system. And what you do to indigent defense, to the courts, to corrections, to whatever, does have an effect on DAs, and the DA cuts or increases or whatever have effects on the rest of the system. That is my summary, Mr. Chair. The analysis is attached to the back.
Thank you, Doug. Mr. Williams, thanks and welcome again. Thank you, Chair Patridge and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here. You may or may not recall that I have become a frequent flyer. I spoke to you regarding the Judicial Department's budget. I spoke to you regarding the Attorney General's budget. I spoke to you regarding indigent defense budget. And I'm going to have more fun today talking. This is probably not the most dazzling presentation I'll make, but for me, it's the one that I am most concerned about, and it was the most fun to prepare some notes for, because it talks about our 36 elected DAs and our 320 deputy district attorneys, 320 and dropping, maybe down to about 300 today. In January, it was 320. I want to talk about our roles and a little bit about what we have to do, a little bit about how we do them, and then what we need to continue to do them. And my presentation will be less than 10 minutes today. The Constitution establishes our role. We're the law officers of the state and of the counties in our districts. We, of course, are elected officials. We serve four-year terms, and our duties are set by you, the legislature. We have many duties outside the criminal justice system. Some examples are bringing actions to stop nuisances, to establish paternity, to forfeit property, to collect some costs of local government. We represent the state in dependency, juvenile dependency actions. We advise county officers. We advise county employees. We prepare ballot titles for local initiative measures, and some of us serve as county council. Those are obviously non-criminal duties. Of course, our main functions are prosecution of crimes and also prosecution of non-criminal violations, as we discussed yesterday, juvenile delinquency acts, enforcement of child support orders, and the protection of the rights of crime victims. Our responsibilities are numerous, way too numerous to list them all today, but I would like to recap some as they relate to the criminal justice system. We appear in all courts in our counties, in both state and county courts. We advise police officers. We review or write search warrant affidavits and applications for court orders. We coordinate grand jury proceedings. We advise grand jurors on the law. We present indictments to them. We issue subpoenas. We initiate contempt actions to enforce court orders. We appear in expungement proceedings, and we appear in proceedings to reinstate gun possession rights of convicted felons. We appear at second look sentencing or dispositional hearings for juveniles. We make charging decisions every day. We appear in motion hearings. We represent the state in jury trials. We represent the people of the state in non-jury trials, and we negotiate many cases through plea agreements. And along with medical examiners, we are responsible for all unattended death investigations in our counties. In short, we are the people's lawyers in criminal court. We're also involved in a lot of other broader criminal justice issues. For example, we're members and participants on local public safety coordinating councils and on local multidisciplinary child abuse teams. And our members serve communities in various participation and leadership roles in boards and committees and commissions relating to drug and alcohol abuse and family violence and elder abuse, juvenile delinquency, community education and prevention programs, teen pregnancy prevention, tobacco prevention coalitions, drug court programs. We direct and serve on major crime teams and on interagency drug task forces. It is a great job, but it's not necessarily an easy one. We and our family members are sometimes faced with personal threats on our safety as a result of the work that we do. We make decisions every day that have a huge impact on citizens in our communities. We work under the watchful eye of citizens and the media and other governmental agencies, and we sometimes face criticism to which we cannot respond because of ethical considerations. But we do our work with enthusiasm because every day we prosecute cases that involve the most important of rights afforded to all Oregonians, the rights to their safety and their freedom. We are a key player in the criminal justice system because through the charging function, we decide what cases enter it. At least up until last March 1st, we decided which cases enter it. Since last month, the court, through budgetary and policy decisions, have decided that not all the cases we file on get entered, at least not for now. But historically, we decide what cases to proceed on, what charges to file, and which cases go into court. And so the quality and the character of the entire criminal justice system is shaped by our decisions. It's a big job with a lot of responsibility, and it's very rewarding, but we can't do it alone. We need to have help to get our job done, and some of the help is the support of public safety partners like the court system and indigent defense folks and law enforcement, and of course we need the support of our communities or else we can't do our jobs. And we need financial support. We need the resources to hold criminals accountable and to protect crime victims. Over the past 30 years, state contributions for our jobs, for our offices, have decreased. They've gone from about 20% of the total cost of prosecution down to less than 9% this year. State funding, of course, for other public safety agencies has greatly increased. That's understandable. If you look at the Judicial Department, including Indigent Defense, Youth, now it's called Oregon Youth Authority, Department of Corrections, the state funding for all of those agencies have decreased greatly over the years. That's because the state pays 100% of the costs of those programs. The state pays less than 9% of the cost of the prosecution function in Oregon. We are state elected officials prosecuting state crimes created by the state legislature. We represent all of the citizens of the state. That's what the Constitution says. But our state funding continues to decrease year after year. Counties, therefore, pick up the ball. Counties' share of the funding has been increasing year after year for 30 years. But the counties can no longer afford, there is a cap, there's a line, and the counties can no longer afford to keep up with increased costs. New crimes, more complex procedures, new responsibilities and duties have all been accompanied by reductions in state funding. Public safety is job one of government, and all parts of the public safety system have to be funded to do that job, including prosecution. Our citizens expect that, and our citizens certainly deserve it. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Hold on, Gary.
I'm sorry.
Questions for Mr. Williams? Senator George.
Mr. Williams, there is a real indication that CERS reform is stalled in this building. And every one of the budgets looks just like this. I mean, are you guys going to be able to advocate strongly that we get something done for CERS reform? Because every budget is going to be impacted so greatly. I listened to my county commissioners on the way in here, there's all three of them, on the way in here this morning on the radio. And they were cutting three positions here, and from the DA support to the Public Works Department, I mean, you name it. They were talking about cuts they were having to make, and the question was asked by the host, what's the cost? PERS. I mean, are you folks aware that we're in trouble here?
We are, Chair Patridge, Senator George, we are aware that there's a problem. I wasn't aware that the PERS reform was look installed in the building. I had been reading the newspaper over the past several weeks, and I really didn't get that impression, at least not in the local newspaper that I was reading. We are aware, as 36 elected DAs and as 36 public employees who have the benefit of PERS system, we are aware that there is a tremendous problem that needs to be solved in this legislature. Yes, we have not discussed as a group any formal position on that, but every one of us individually knows that it's got to be fixed, and it's got to be fixed in this session.
Thank you, Senator. Was Representative Butler?
Yeah, Chair, I don't want to belabor this, but I would like to have a list. I understand that there's, I think, a total of five compensation schedules for the 36 district attorneys and four
tiers.
Okay, and I'd like to have those four tiers and the counties that they're affecting. And you don't need to get that for me right now. Thank you.
I think we're going
to
go into the formula
good.
Tomorrow.
Great.
I think part of the intent was to worry the formula.
Wonderful.
Tomorrow.
I won't bother you with the thing, Gary.
Thank you.
I think Doug will bring that. Richard?
Mr. Chairman, if this question should be compared tomorrow, I'll do that. But, my question was about the funding for deputies, supplements, and witness fees. Obviously, witness fees being eliminated. Obviously, the district attorneys disagree with the amount that the governor's budgeted. But do they agree with this distribution formula for what the governor has budgeted? Because it appears that he's virtually practically budgeted them all the same at almost the bottom level.
Chair Patridge, Senator Devlin, that was the formula that we didn't have a lot of input into the governor's budget, proposed budget regarding the distribution, the formula of the and the how the individual payments are going to be made to the counties or in what quarters or in what amounts. And so I'm not sure. I can't tell you that there was stated or official disagreement with the budget and the schedules that set forth in the proposed budget, but there was no stated consensus either.
It may be a situation, I'm not sure of this, where there is an existing formula, and if you put that much revenue through the formula, that's what comes out. It appears to just fund the most of them just at a very base level, regardless of their size or number of cases or anything.
Obviously, that's a substantial reduction from previous years, and of course, and as I mentioned a few moments ago, the problem with that is that counties are going to have to backfill the money or lose the positions, and we're anticipating experiencing both situations in the next few months.
Other questions? Marla, do you have something to add in regard to the formula?
Chair Patridge, Marla Ray, representing Oregon's district attorneys. Tomorrow, our proposal to you and to the committee would be to have you hear from Dale Penn on each of the elements in our budget. Excuse me. And Dale can be prepared at that time to go through the formula that existed for both deputy supplements and witness fees. Doug Harkle Road from Lane County will follow him and fill you in on the implications to each of those counties and what's happening at the county level. And we'll be prepared also to address Representative Butler's question tomorrow
on regard to the salaries.
On where they fall.
And Mr. Chair, I would suggest we start off with Linda Gilbert from
yes.
GAM to go through the governor's budget before those two.
All right.
And if there are other issues that you want us to be prepared for,
any other issues the committee has in regards to DAs and the supplements and Representative Bella?
I just say, Mr. Chair, that the appearance is that the governor has made a concerted effort to make certain that between the witness fees and district attorney supplements, that the burden of funding the district attorney and their deputy programs in the state of Oregon, I believe that the governor has appeared to try and shift that over to the counties. And I'm anxious about that because after all the rest of the takings from the counties, and I don't think that the district attorneys nor their deputies had anything to do with the increase in administrative costs over the issue of torts. If anything, the current governor had as much to do with that as anyone has by sitting on the Supreme Court and doing what the Supreme Court has done to us. So I'm very anxious about what the governor is doing here.
Okay. Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, although it directly impacts the DAs, and it's probably more an appropriate discussion on the General Government Committee, and I know we've discussed this issue and given a solution to court reform, I would like to...
Which you're prepared to vote for, isn't that correct, Senator Devlin?
I would like to explore to see if there are any other alternatives in terms, because this... This charge for liability is affecting a lot of budgets, and we depleted our reserves, I understand that, in the last biennium down to literally zero. But I wonder if there are any other alternatives we could explore. I know the chair has voiced tort reform as one of those, but...
Mr. Chair, and yes. On the schedule tomorrow also we gave it Hartwig from DAS. I brought him...
Yes.
Specifically because of your concerns, the committee's members have just concerns about the tort liability assessment.
I think the only other issue I'd like the DAs to address tomorrow in light of questions that have been raised today are in regard to the witness fees and the reductions in those, what occurs. And I don't know what the provisions are in statute. We probably want to pull that statute tomorrow, Doug, and I don't know what our federal requirements are, our constitutional requirements, and maybe if you can fill us in on our federal and constitutional requirements, I'm sure we can get something out of legislative council in regard to that, but whether in light of the current budget situations we can stay that statute or not, I don't know if that is a possibility or if that works for the DAs or the counties. I don't see anyone here from the camp.
Yes.
Oh, there's Paul.
Paul.
All right, Paul. Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned for today, and we will carry. Well,
we're adjourned for today.
We'll come to carry this over. Official.
We're going to carry over Senate Bill 5516 until tomorrow.
Thank you.